Well, good evening. My name is George Gillum. I'm with the Miller Center of Public Affairs, and I'm delighted to see all of you, and particularly grateful to the College Republicans and College Democrats for sharing very valuable pre-election time to come out tonight to hear these scholars from the Brookings Institution. I see Savannah and some red friends over here, and Sarah and some blue friends over here. Is that the way the room divides? Is this pretty much the red team and this pretty much the blue team? Are you all in the middle, sort of undecided?
No, I'm like a little on the wall.
Well, this should be very interesting, and we're very pleased that you are here. I also want to thank the Brookings Institution in Washington for agreeing to come here and share the very important research that they are doing on America's polarized politics, something that's been of some interest to all of us. This evening's conversation will have a presentation of the Brookings Institution study, Red and Blue Nation, with a question mark at the end, which explores political polarization and its possible causes and the consequences of this gulf between the red states and the blue states. The authors examine the impact of these political divisions on voter behavior, on congressional lawmaking, on judicial selection, on redistricting, on the way religion is used in political campaigns, foreign policy formation, and a number of other topics. The conversation tonight will begin with a presentation by one, and we hope two, Brookings Institution scholars. Pietro Nivola is, we hope, lost trying to find his way to Park 108. We've asked the NSA to tap all cell phone communications and see if they can find where he is, but he right now is missing in action.
But the good news is they don't have any masks. The bad news is they have 5 billion
But we're delighted to have an old friend starting it off tonight, William Galston. And after Professor Galston's presentation, then Sarah Buckley and Susan Fisher from the College Democrats, and Savannah Rutherford and Amanda Nichols from the College Republicans will come up here, and there will be a discussion between them and the professors, and we will invite members of the audience to participate. And I think we'll try to wrap up, what, about 7:30? That sound about right to everybody? Bill Galston is a senior fellow in the Ezra K. Zilka Chair in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's a former policy advisor to President Clinton and other presidential candidates, and is an expert on domestic policy, political campaigns, and elections. His current research focuses on designing a new social contract and the implications of political polarization. So please welcome Bill Galston.
Well, thank you so much for that kind introduction, and thanks to all of you for turning out tonight. I understand there are a number of attractive competing events that the two clubs have dispatched their members to cover all of them, but I'm pleased that so many of you are here. I just want to take a few minutes to explain the project that I'm going to be discussing. And then to draw some of its implications for the presidential campaign, which we're now enmeshed. About 5 years ago, a great debate broke out among political scientists and political sociologists. There was a widespread perception, certainly in Washington and in the journalistic community and among the punditocracy, that American politics had gotten a lot more polarized than it used to be. And then a group of scientists at Stanford by the name of Morris Fiorina wrote a book called Culture War? In which, in table after table and graph after graph, he did his best to debunk the idea that political polarization in the United States had actually increased. Well, as you might imagine, when you have a clash between a reputable scholar on the one hand and widespread perceptions on the part of journalists and the people as a whole, that is the occasion for a robust scholarly debate that also has a public dimension. That's exactly what happened. And after about a year of that debate, my colleague Pietro Nivola, will be joining us shortly, I hope, got the idea of putting together a major study group involving some of the best scholars and journalists and political analysts in the country, and doing it as befits the subject on a bipartisan basis. So Brookings teamed up. Excuse me, it's maybe here, Trump. Hello? Yeah. I'm in Clark Hall lecturing. Where are you? but the event is over here at Clark Hall. Hold on for just a minute, please. Let me.
Pietro has been battled.
Yes, he's at the Miller Center. So moving right along. So we teamed up and and put together a series of meetings that produced these two volumes, Red and Blue Nation, And let me tell you very briefly what we found, and then to explain it. We did indeed find that, as we did historical analytical studies, that the impression of the public and journalistic community is not misplaced. That political polarization in the United States has indeed increased quite significantly over the past 3 decades. And we found further that this increase is not only, as some people have hypothesized, at the level of political elites. It's not just elected officials. It's among the American people as a whole. But you might ask at this point, that's interesting, but what do you mean by polarization anyway? And let me give you three different interpretations of polarization, which are not mutually exclusive or contradictory, and we used all three of them in our study. The first has to do with the distribution of ideological sentiment in the electorate as a whole. As you may know, there's a group called the National Election Studies out of the University of Michigan that does serious, rigorous, in-depth post-election surveys, usually every 2 years, occasionally every four if they're out of money, which they have recently. And they ask the question about how voters think of themselves, how they place themselves on a 7-point ideological spectrum, where there's very conservative, conservative, moderate conservative, moderate, and then moderately liberal, liberal, very liberal, sort of 0-7. And 30 years ago, you had a very standard-looking bell curve, with relatively few people calling themselves conservative or very conservative or liberal and very liberal, and lots of people putting themselves in the middle three categories, moderate conservative, moderate or moderate liberal. Over the past quarter century, substantial numbers of people have distributed themselves away from the middle and toward the left and the right tail of that bell curve. That is to say, as compared to 25 years ago, a higher percentage of citizens think of themselves as either conservative or very conservative or liberal or very liberal than was the case a generation ago. It's still the case that there are more moderate, there's still more people in the middle than at the left tail or the right tail, but the proportion has changed in a way that has real political significance. Secondly, the second interpretation of political polarization has to do with the official stances of the political parties. Pedro Nolan and I actually take party platforms seriously. And I think we're right to do so, because party platforms may not be binding contracts with the American people, but they tend to reflect what the most committed and well-informed supporters of the two major political parties actually think about the issues of the day. And studies that have been done by different people, including myself, have documented the fact, and Pedro gets here in time, we can do it by the slideshow, and if not, I'll just lay it out for you verbally, that the party platforms have moved farther apart. I myself wrote an article a few years ago in which I charted the evolution of the abortion issue in the two party platforms, and it's very interesting. In 1972, before Roe v. Wade, the platforms were nearly silent on the issue of abortion for a very good reason. It wasn't a national issue at all. Roe was the critical step in nationalizing the abortion issue. In 1976, you could tell that the Democratic Party was heading in a pro-choice direction. The Republican Party was heading more in a pro-life direction. But each of the party platforms read, had phrases like, "We recognize that this is a difficult issue on which men and women of goodwill and conscience can and do disagree, and our party has plenty of room for people who take conscientious positions, whatever they may be, on this issue." By 1980, it was clear that there was a majority pro-choice in the Democratic Party and a majority pro-life in the Republican Party, but there was still an acknowledgement of the legitimacy of minority views. And by 1984, election I remember very well because I was Walter Mondale's issues director in his presidential campaign, the two parties were starkly polarized. And the 84 Democratic platform gave no aid and comfort to people who took pro-life views, and the Republican platform was equally staunch on the other side. And you can see in the most recent 10-year period similar evolutions on other issues. For example, the Democratic and Republican platforms were quite close together on Iraq in 2000, George W. Bush ran against Al Gore Jr. They were within hailing distance even in 2004. If you don't believe me, let me read you the 2004 Democratic Party platform, and I think it may surprise you. It says, "Today we know the mission is not finished, hostilities have not ended. We will meet these challenges and win the peace in Iraq, so that Iraq will be a responsible member of the international community, not a breeding ground for terror and intolerance." That sort of sounds like something that a well-phrased Republican platform might say. Now here's the 2008 platform, the Democratic Party. We favor ending this war and giving Iraq back to its people. We can safely remove our combat brigades at the pace of 1 or 2 per month and expect a complete redeployment within 16 months. And finally, Iraq was a diversion from the fight against the terrorists who struck us on 9/11. So you can see, and here's what the 2005 platform said, just to give you a baseline. Al Gore will not hesitate to use America's military might against Iraq when and where it is necessary. Well, that sounds pretty bellicose, doesn't it? So that's one example. We have dozens in our work of the evolution of party platforms from moderation towards starker and more extremes, and more extreme views. Some would say clearer views. The third definition of polarization that we use is what we call alignment. And that is very simply a measure of the relationship between your partisanship, how you identify yourself, and your vote. And there's a high degree of polarization from this standpoint if almost all Democrats vote for the Democratic candidate and almost all Republicans vote for the Republican candidate. It is quite literally the case that since the baseline election of 1976, the percentage of Democrats who vote for Republican candidates has been cut in half, and the percentage of self-identified Republicans who vote for Democratic candidates has been cut in half. That's another indicator of polarization, namely alignment. Okay, that roughly speaking is what we found. I've given you a 10-minute précis of two thick volumes of essays. And when Pietro and I were thinking about this talk, we asked ourselves, well, okay, what does this mean for 2008? And let me just give you the story very, very briefly. I think we're all familiar with the famous red and blue maps, the 2000 map, the 2004 map, and as recently as 6 weeks ago, the 2008 bore an uncanny resemblance to the 2000 map and the 2004 map. It seemed to be the same close red-blue divide. Now, obviously, things have changed a lot in recent weeks. The financial crisis has proved to be the economic equivalent of a 9/11 attack. And it has had the same sort of impact on Senator McCain's campaign that another major terrorist strike would have had and might still have on Senator Obama's campaign. That's not a prediction, but just a possibility. And so we seem to be looking now at an election that may turn out not to be that close. There are some people who guess that Senator Obama might win as many as 364 electoral votes versus only 174 for Senator McCain. And clearly, a lot of states that were pink or bright red for 4 years ago are now purple, if not light blue, including the one in which this discussion is taking place as we speak. So, does this mean that this election is witnessing the end of political polarization? And our answer to that question is no, not so fast. And to see why, you just have to make a very simple distinction. A country can be closely divided, but not deeply divided, or deeply divided, but not closely divided. In 1960, for example, the country was very closely divided, just fractions of 1 percentage point separated John F. Kennedy and Richard Nixon in the popular vote. But the political parties were actually very close together. As a matter of fact, a favorite exercise that people of my generation sometimes inflict on our students is to produce transcripts of the Kennedy-Nixon debates, cover over the names of the speakers, and then invite the students to identify the speakers, this Kennedy or Nixon. And the identification, the rate of success is usually about random. And the reason for that is that it's very difficult, in fact, to tell who was speaking. Typically, the person who was slightly more hawkish was not Richard Nixon, but John F. Kennedy, which is very disorienting for people of your generation. So, a country can be closely divided politically, but not deeply divided. Conversely, a country can be deeply divided, but not closely divided. By the time that Franklin Roosevelt won his landslide re-election in 1936, I mean, the Democrats were the dominant party. Does that mean that they had somehow persuaded the Republican minority to see things their way? Absolutely not. The division between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party on fundamentals, the role of government in the economy and society, was massive. And the level of conservative hatred for Franklin Roosevelt, who was accused of being a traitor to his class, a fascist, a communist, and everything in between, that level of bitterness was sky high. If you don't believe me, just take a look at some of the famous New Yorker cartoons from that period. It is our thesis, in fact, that regardless of the size of Senator Obama's victory, assuming that unless something cataclysmic happens that he will win, regardless of the size of his victory, it will not signal the diminution of political polarization. In fact, it is our thesis, which my colleague is about to present with some wonderful graphics, that if anything, the polarization between the two political parties has widened in this election year, and that the president-elect will inherit a sharply polarized political system, and will then have to try to figure out whether to govern on the basis of a unified party majority, with the White House, the House, and the Senate all being in the hands of the same party, or whether to try to reach out and conciliate, but conciliate not across a narrow divide, but across a chasm. And with that set up, I think I have filibustered just long enough, so keep it now, make real presentation. Yeah, hang on, don't worry.
Well, first of all, I had to duck into a telephone booth and dress up for this. I'm sorry I'm late because I was confused. I thought we were supposed to meet at the Miller Center and then we got switched. So, forgive me for being so tardy. I'm sure that my colleague Bill Galson has teed me up just perfectly, but let me just back up a little bit and say that, you know, one of the things that we were wondering back in the middle of the summer when we were first beginning to think about coming down here to UVA to talk to people about our project and about the election was that this election was going to be very much like the preceding two presidential elections. And the first thing we thought we'd do is put up on the screen the map of the 2000 election and then the 2004 election, and then we figured, okay, the 2008 election is going to look exactly like that, red and blue states, exactly pretty much the same pattern. Well, it's not shaping up that way, frankly. It's beginning that the earth is beginning to shake here a little bit. There's some momentum, there's a wave developing, and it may in fact wash over some of the traditional red and blue map that we've seen in the last two presidential elections, and produce a lot more states that are neither red or blue, but actually purple, if you were to look at the current state of play, including the where we're sitting right now, the state of Virginia. So the question, I guess, that this raises for our study, as Bill just said, we think that partisan polarization, as he's defined it, where the center of gravities of the two parties have moved further to the right and the left than they've been traditionally, and have become much more homogeneous in that sense. That even though this has become fairly hardwired in recent years, It's possible for a tsunami to come along and blow this whole thing wide open, right? It's conceivable. I mean, that does happen. There are two types of tidal waves that can really change the political landscape. There are realigning elections like the one in 1932, or there are elections, I guess more like the one in 1980. That's not the best example, but there are other elections where it's pretty lopsided, but then the other party comes back and regains some foothold again. So we're not sure which of those scenarios is going to play out this time. If you have the latter type of election where it's a tidal wave of sorts, it just sort of washes over the various divides in the society and the various fault lines, but then it ebbs and retreats, and pretty soon those fault lines and divisions reappear, then in fact what you have is a much more permanent form of polarization, which is I think where we come down. That's where our best guess is. Now, let me just say a few words with these charts and stuff that we've got here about why we think this is the case. That is, why we think that this is not the beginnings of a sort of, quote, post-partisan era, but is in fact going to be more of the same eventually in terms of a real divide real disparity, divergence between Democrats and Republicans. For one thing, Obama, we feel, has been running somewhat to the left of where his two Democratic presidential candidates ran, Kerry in 2004, Gore, and by the way, his running mate was Joe Lieberman, if you recall, in 2000. You didn't hear Al Gore, for example, complain about the NAFTA and trade. You didn't hear John Kerry talk about quick withdrawal from Iraq. You didn't even hear John Kerry talk about raising corporate taxes. In fact, he was in favor of lowering corporate taxes. And in neither of the last two presidential campaigns did you hear Democratic candidates really champion the notion of universal health care, which is a very expensive proposition, a radical proposition. Well, that's what's changed. I mean, Obama's, in that sense, running more as a traditional liberal than those two guys were. We feel that McCain, the maverick, is actually running to the right of where Bush ran in 2000. Don't forget, George Bush ran as a compassionate conservative. He called for reforms like the No Child Left Behind education reform. He championed major increases in foreign aid. He talked about being a uniter, not a divider, and so on. I mean, basically, he was trying to move the Republican Party more toward the center. I would say that McCain is actually may by instinct be a centrist, but he's been forced pretty much by his base to run further to the right than where he actually is as a politician. So, for example, he's jettisoned his previous opposition to the Bush tax cuts and so on, and become much more of a traditional supply side Republican and so forth. So. That's sort of how the two campaigns have shaped up. Now, let's take a look here at just to hammer this point home, if I can figure out how this works. Okay, what we're going to show you is just some quick comparisons, and Bill might want to join in on this. He actually participated in writing some Democratic platforms at one point. But we're going to show you the two-party platforms over the years. And we sort of cherry-picked a bunch of issues. But let's take trade. If you look at these sentences that we plucked from the party platforms in 2000, 2004, and 2008, you see a real progression toward a much more sort of diffident attitude, a much more skeptical attitude about free trade than what you had back in 2000, where they're extolling open markets, and in 2004, arguing that American good workers and can easily compete in the global economy. By 2008, you get the Democratic platform saying, well, maybe we better sit down with Canada and Mexico and renegotiate NAFTA. Now that's a real change. Okay, Christina, do I just hit these buttons here?
The arrow on the side.
Huh?
The arrow on the side.
On the side, okay, the next one, all right. On healthcare, quickly, in the Democratic National Platform, yes, it's traditionally said that it would be a nice idea to have to insure the uninsured and have more general, wider coverage. But in 2000, they're saying, well, we'll do this in a step-by-step, incremental way. In 2004, they're saying, they're using a very vague expression here, we'll do it and we'll have a comprehensive approach to healthcare. But by 2008, it's saying that basically universal coverage is a moral imperative. That's pretty strong language. And to me, it suggests a movement to the left. Now, here's the big enchilada, of course, Iraq.
I already did this one.
You did?
Okay.
We've gone from, you know, basically a considerable convergence between Democrat and Republican positions in the previous two elections to you know, let's end this war and get out as quickly as possible, which is 16 months. On the Republican side, it's a little different. Here you see, I'm moving quickly, but if you were to whip through these blurbs here, there's consistency. There's the hard line on Iraq is sort of pretty consistent. From 2000 through 2004, 2008, there isn't that much change. In 2008, they're certainly rejecting the notion of a timetable or a timeline for withdrawal. Okay. So, pretty hard line on Iraq in comparison with the Democrats. Here's an interesting one. On immigration, just take a moment to read these three years. What are you picking up here? I'll give you a minute. What are you sort of noticing?
Move to the right.
Yeah, I mean, and why? Why do you see that?
Because before that, they said informal immigration system ensured it's legal, safe, and will command. Now they're saying federal law more than giving us a tuition rate.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's just getting progressively tougher, especially on illegal immigrants. And it's certainly not making any reference to the need for immigrants, legal or illegal, in the labor force. I mean, the other 2 years, at least they're saying, well, this is an economic issue here. We need immigrants for economic reasons. By the time you get to 2008, it's pretty puny by comparison. Okay, so this is at the level of sort of the elites, the people that go to party conventions and that write party platforms and so on. And you can expect them to be more polarized. But what about the electorate at large? I mean, what about just regular old Democratic and Republican voters? I mean, one of the things about polarization when it's serious is that it's not just at the level of elites, it's not just in the Congress, and it's not just at the among the people who vote in the primaries or the people who go to conventions, but it actually extends down into the public at large. And what we're finding here is that when you compare sort of what the partisan priorities are, just among people in surveys, okay, Republicans and Democrats in the electorate, you find quite dramatic differences in what they consider to be priorities. For example, increasing the minimum wage, very few Republicans espouse that. Overwhelming share of Democrats do. Health insurance for the uninsured, very few Republicans, many, many Democrats. Dealing with illegal immigration, here's where the Republicans really want to hit back hard, and the Democrats are less psyched about that. Dealing with global warming, this is a much bigger priority among Democratic voters than it is among Republicans. On the sort of defense and foreign policy types of issues, strengthening the military is a big priority for Republicans, and less so for the Democrats. Look at the one on Iraq, and I'm going to come back to another chart which is even more impressive than this. But the one on the right, upper right. Where you've got, you know, only 15% of Republicans favoring a timetable for withdrawal, and 81% of Democratic voters saying that they favor it. I mean, that's a huge chasm, okay? And even on defending against terrorism, you see a considerable gap between between Democrats and Republicans. Now, here's the thing that's really fascinating to Bill and me. This is a comparison. I mean, when I was sitting in a classroom like you guys are, it was during the Vietnam War, okay? And you all have the Iraq War to deal with, but when I was in college, I don't have a pointer here, but you can see that Democrats and Republicans were both By the early 1970s, it didn't matter whether you were Republican or Democrat. The public, you know, regardless of partisan affiliation, began sensing that it had been a big mistake since Vietnam. But now look at what's going on today, or pretty much today, over here with Iraq. Look at the enormous difference between Democrats and Republicans, with 21% saying that it was the wrong, 21% of Republicans saying it was the wrong decision to take military action on Iraq, but 74% of Democrats feeling that way. So the conduct of these wars has become a highly partisan issue, and this comparison is very telling. This is just a thing about different perceptions of how people look at Tina Fey. I mean, it is striking in that 84% of Republicans have a favorable opinion, but only 23% of Democrats. Again, it's just a really enormous gap. We wanted to throw in one more little chart. This is somewhat about current events. This was the recent vote on the bailout package in the House of Representatives. And this is just to give you a sense of how polarized the voting can be in the House of Representatives, where we broke it down according to the ideologies of the members, liberals on the left, conservatives on the right, various kinds of centrists. What you'll notice in here is that the center is pretty cramped. I mean, there isn't much of it, right? And the most liberal members voted quite differently from the most conservative members. The most conservative members were overwhelmingly opposed to the bailout initially. Passed the second time, but on September 29th, overwhelming opposition by conservatives. And liberals were not overwhelmingly, but they were largely for it. Okay, most of the support for it came from liberals who were arguing, that it's fine to have that much government intervention. For conservatives, it's anathema to have that much government intervention. Okay, so those are the graphics. Now, Bill, we should carry on, or we can have just some discussion about all this.
Here's the
choreography. We'd like to do.
Here's the choreography. At this point, after I put one more minute of data on the table, two representatives of the College Republicans will occupy, I guess, these seats. Two representatives of the College Democrats, I guess, will occupy these seats, and will be available as well. I just wanted to make one more data point based on some recent surveys that I've been looking at, very recent. And I'll just give you three facts that give some more texture and some more support to these very dramatic graphics that Pietro has just presented. A Gallup survey was taken 3 weeks ago, and here was the question. Is government doing too much to solve our nation's problems, or should it do more? And here were the results. 33% of Democrats thought that government was doing too much. 62% thought that government should do more than it's now doing. The comparable breakdown for Republicans was 78-19. 78% of Republicans thought the government was already doing too much, and please don't do more. And only 19% thought that the government should do more. Here are some numbers from a recent Pew Research Center survey. Is America divided between the haves and have-nots, or isn't it? 63% of Democrats said yes, it is. Only 33% of Republicans said that it is. 20 years earlier, there was very little difference between Democrats and Republicans in their response to that question. Final little fact, and this is drawn from a Bloomberg LA Times survey released just today. A lot of Americans think that the financial crisis has revealed a failure of regulation. But the two parties respond very differently, members of the two parties, when they're asked, well, should we have more regulation of business in order to try to minimize the chances of this sort of thing to happen? Again, in this survey, 58% of Democrats said, yes, we ought to have new regulations. The comparable figure for Republicans was 24%. In other words, there are fundamental differences, not only on particular policies, but also on broad outlook and even worldview between the two political parties. I can assure you that that was not true in 1976, and I can assure you that it was not true in 1956, but it is, we believe, very much true today. With that, the show is yours.
Representing the Republicans, are speaking for the Republicans tonight are Savannah Rutherford and Amanda Nichols, who will be seated here. Maybe I'll reverse you now. Republicans on the left and the Democrats on the right, but not draw any conclusions from it. And from the College Dems, Sarah Buckley and Susan Fisher. And we want this to be a student-led discussion, and we want Bill and Pietro to jump in whenever appropriate. But let me toss out one question just to sort of kick it off. Their research shows an increase in polarization on certain issues. And I think the comment was made that Obama's running more as a traditional liberal and McCain is running more as a traditional conservative than was the case in 2000 and 2004. From where you all sit, has this polarization made it easier to recruit people who are interested in participating in the political campaign? And what do you think that it holds for the future governance? Maybe Savannah, you want to go first, or Amanda?
I would say this has, I think it depends on which demographic you're talking to. Recruiting college students, I feel like this has made it a little more difficult because so many college students, I feel now, are maybe more liberal on social issues, but maybe more, I guess, more libertarian maybe, and you get the traditional Republican platform that is very conservative across the board. And so I think sometimes that bothers some students, but in talking to older, like older generations, I don't think it's really made it any easier or any more difficult.
Well, I would say there's the thought that when like the public becomes more acrimonious, then the public becomes more affected. And I think that when the public is more affected, we tend to find people who might not otherwise become so involved in campaigns, willing to, you know, side with one of these sides, because it's easier for them to see the issues and really think about what they care about. So I think in a sense, it really has been easier this election for more people to really feel like they're making a difference because there's something that they believe in because of such the like the larger gap initiatives.
Bill, Pietro, do you want to weigh in on this?
Sure. Bill, come
in. Okay. By the way, we don't have the books here, or do we? Because I read them actually. And there's
we're not going to let anybody leave without having the opportunity to buy a book.
Right. Okay. The thing is, that, there's a chapter in the second volume. By Mark Hetherington of Vanderbilt University. What he finds there is very interesting evidence that increased polarization, that is differentiation between the parties, stimulates political engagement, political participation, and higher voter turnouts. Because it's clear that, and it's for the, exactly for the reason that you gave, that, you know, as we say, there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the parties, people didn't think it was particularly exciting to vote in an election because what difference did it make? But when you have this clarification and you get what Barry Goldwater called a real choice and not an echo, okay, that gets people excited and animated. And so what we're seeing in recent elections is much higher voter turnout. And that's the upside of polarization.
Now here's the downside. Also drawn from Mark Hetherington's work. Polarization increases political engagement. It also decreases political trust. And so one of the things that we've seen is as polarization has galloped forward in the past 10 years or so, trust in government has been cut in half. And it wasn't so great 10 years ago. But now, I actually just wrote an article on patterns of political trust and mistrust. As of the most recent survey, we are now tied for the lowest reading on the political trust scale that survey research has ever uncovered. So congratulations. I mean, you are now living in an electoral cycle where the percentage of turnout in this election may rival the fabled heights of the mid and late 1960s. But where the mistrust between the parties and also the mistrust of people for government is going to make it extremely difficult to translate the results of the election into a successful and effective government strategy. So polarization, in short, is a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm.
We would like to continue the discussion. Yes, sir.
Yeah. I have one question from all these studies that you made on polarization over the last 30 years or so. Did you also track any perception of how effective the government seemed to be on handling a wide range of issues over that time? Because I would assume that as polarization goes up, you get a sharper split and other people say, well, the government is taking care of this and this very well, or it's not doing it well at all, go up as well. In terms of perceptions of how effective governments have been.
Boy, that's a very good question. That's a very good question and a very complicated one. And let me just give you the sketch of the answer. Sketch of an answer, not the answer. And that is that This concept of trust in government actually contains two dimensions. One of them is that we either believe or don't believe that government is trying to do the right thing, that it cares about the people, it cares about people like us, and is trying to do what we want it to do, is trying to do something that would be helpful rather than reverse. But the second dimension has less to do with government's intention but with its competence. And so when trust in government declines, it can mean one of two things, or maybe both of them. Number one, they're all just a bunch of crooks. They're in hock to the special interests. They don't care about us. They're not trying to do the right thing. They're in it for themselves, and they're paying off their friends. Okay? The other, the other possibility is people say, well, you know, they tried, but they really blew it. And I don't think a lot of people believe, for example, that President Bush and his administration didn't care what happened to the people of New Orleans. Some people said that, but I think most people didn't say that. Most people didn't believe that. What you had there was a failure of competence and not a failure of motivation. It's a little bit difficult to tell in most cases whether people think that government is not to be trusted because it's not motivated correctly, as opposed to not arranged appropriately to get the job done. But when you have catastrophes like the financial catastrophe of the past month, then there's clear survey evidence that people across the board believe that government was asleep at the switch. Right? Nobody believes that the government wanted this financial meltdown to happen. But everybody believes that government was not foresighted enough, it was not careful enough, it was not skillful enough to pick up the warning signs that would have enabled it to ward off at least the worst excesses. So, when you have really dramatic policy failures, like a failed economy or a failed war, then you can tell that it's very clear that it's the effectiveness component that's driving it. But it's not always that clear because we're not always dealing with fiascos of that sort. In 2006, for example, the Republicans in the House of Representatives got their heads handed to them, largely because of the motivational issue. They're a bunch of crooks, they're corrupt, they're out for themselves. That feeling had settled in by 2006. And I think that was less about confidence, more about corruption.
Can I add a sort of coda to Bill's observations here? I'm not 100% sure this is true, but I'm sort of 95% sure. My sense is that voters punish failures more than they reward successes overall. Successes are kind of taken for granted. Right? Failures just become these flagrant things that people really zero in on. But here's the point. In a polarized partisan environment, there's a strong tendency to accentuate both failures and successes by either side. In other words, Republicans ask Republicans, how badly did the Bush administration fail in Iraq? They say, well, it kind of did, but not, it wasn't an abject failure. You ask Democrats that, they think it was a calamity, a debacle. On issues such as the economy, is a different thing. The economy is having a very broad impact on voters across the board, including making inroads into, deep into the Republican side. But on something like Katrina, for example, how that was managed. I mean, Republicans thought, well, that was mismanaged, but they didn't make that big a deal out of it. For Democrats, it was very good. So, but in general, I mean, the tendency with successes is they just don't get the credit that sometimes that they might deserve, whereas failures really get magnified and amplified.
Well, there's a follow-up to that.
Sorry?
as a follow-up to that, though, would you agree that an excessively polarized, ideologically polarized government is not as conducive to as functional a government once it gets to a certain extreme where you have literally the two sides can't work together on passing things like legislation? The compromise breaks down.
Right. Well, see, that goes back to the earlier distinction between closely divided and deeply divided. In 1936, the Republican Party was way over here, and the Democratic Party was way over here. But because the Democrats had such overwhelming majorities, Franklin Roosevelt didn't have any particular problems getting his program through. So, in circumstances like the one that we've been in for so long, where the parties are both closely divided and sharply divided, then what you say is an absolutely perfect description of the situation we're in. Where the bigger and more politically difficult the issue, the less likely it is that the political system will address it.
I want to hear from other people, but there's another thing about that, because you're raising incredibly important questions here. Now, one area, for example, where polarized politics really does damage is in dealing with long-term challenges such as deficits, how to control entitlement spending, the whole fiscal issue, right, the long-range issue, because that's by the third rail of politics, right? And neither party can touch that on their own. They will only touch it if the other side touches it, too. So if you don't have any bipartisanship in addressing something like Social Security or Medicare reform, it's not going to happen. So you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Among your members, do you sense that the financial crisis has caused a change in sort of viewing the role that governments ought to play in the economy? Do you see the split being reflected the way they describe among older citizens?
I think you definitely see where a lot of Republicans or like young conservatives or older conservatives would never want that much government basically nationalizing the banks. But at the same time, like when there's not really a clear solution besides that, more people were probably open to the idea of putting much more money in the system than people would have been prior to that.
Without the emergency. What do you see, Sarah?
I see a remarkably similar reaction from University Democrats, and I think that it's illustrative of the fact that young people are tending to be a lot more fiscally conservative. And so among our membership, I feel like, please tell me if I'm wrong, I feel like we are all like, oh, well, yes, this has to be done because we need a solution. But none of us were like, yes, let's spend $700 billion. I can't wait till government takes over those banks. I don't think there's the same kind of fervor about government being able to solve all problems like that. And I think that at least maybe with just the last 8 years of seeing our deficit and our debt grow and grow and grow, it has also pushed Democrats in general in a more fiscally conservative direction.
Do you see a convergence on pragmatic approaches? Is that a factor? And let's try what works regardless of how it might be labeled?
On our end, I would say yes, and I think, especially in Virginia, I think Mark Warner is our best example. He likes to call himself a radical centrist, although that's hard to define. But I feel like Democrats in Virginia and University Democrats are having a trend toward moderation and pragmatism and realizing that answers must be gotten from government, not just ideological arguments.
I'd like to put a question to all four of you. Namely, what kind of impact has this financial crisis had on your overall outlook and your expectations for the future? Would you describe, is it your view that this is just a temporary blip, it will pass and then it's on with the show, more or less as usual? Or are you more likely to view this as a kind of turning point where expectations have to be adjusted fairly significantly. There's no right or wrong answer to that question. That's an open-ended question, but Pietro and I are genuinely interested in how this has affected your generation's post-talents.
As far as the concern with the stock market goes, I know I saw the Dow like dropped another 700 points today or something. I think this is a blip that will also pass. I mean, in the 90s it was tech stocks, in the 80s it was savings and loans, in the 70s it was oil. I think that the problems with the subprime credit and such have been going on for years, and that it has been foreseen by some people in both parties, but has never, the whole idea, the kind of false myth, sense of everyone should be able to own a home, and some people should clearly not be able to own a home. impact, I think people have very short-term memories, and that it will be back to the way it was before post-tech crash, next few quarters of the recession. I know a lot of people are impacted, are feeling the impact more severely and trying to go out and find jobs right now. And that is investment banking, the field of investment banking essentially does not exist anymore, which is really tough for a lot of people here. And I mean, just things like student loans right now, like student lenders, Sally Mae, are just like, student loans are not there right now. So I think people are, for now, are going to be very mistrustful of the stock market, are going to be kind of mistrustful of lending in general. But I think this will pass, and that we will have learned something from it with the increased regulation. I think that, yeah, it will pass.
Susan?
Well, I think we can definitely agree with Amanda. I think short term, you know, we all see that things, we can take things for granted, like higher education or jobs outside of college, and those are going to affect us. But I think at the same time, you know, that with the change of a strong leadership and some bipartisanship in the next 4 years, 8 years, 10 years, where things are going to get better. At the same time, you can still look long-term and ask, you know, we might still have Medicaid benefits and Social Security benefits, but those are definitely going to be different from what our grandparents are experiencing now. And it's probably going to be different in a slightly more negative manner. And so I think, whereas we can remain optimistic, we definitely understand that we need to make certain changes.
And as a fourth year now, looking out to get a job next year, I can only remember last year, my roommate in the same situation, and the thought was, well, there aren't a lot of jobs elsewhere, but at least the campaign market will always stay the same.
That's right.
Always hop on that train.
Right. Well, let me just follow up if I may, and ask the question the way a pollster would ask. Okay, here are your options. You know, even after recent events, do you expect to live 30 years from now, A, better than your parents do, B, about the same as your parents, or C, worse than your parents? How many say A, better than your parents? How many say B, about as well? Well, American optimism is convincing. Let me just make one historical observation, and that is, if a rough patch lasts long enough, it can have a permanent effect on outlook and expectations. So, for example, people of my late father's generation who came to maturity in the decade of the Great Depression were marked by that experience for the rest of their lives. And they did not have the sky's the limit expectations that the people in this room still do. They didn't even necessarily expect that they would live better than their parents. They were grateful if they had a stable job and enough coming in to put bread on the table and keep a roof over the head of their families. And it wasn't until those memories faded and new generations came along that hadn't experienced it that we began to become a much more optimistic people again. And so one question, just one consideration that I put on the table is that so far we've had a slow motion 1929, but we haven't had a depression. If there is an extended period of slow or no growth and income stagnating or declining, 3 or 4 years from now, if we can reconvene this meeting, you may have a different feeling. I hope you don't. I hope this is just like a crash with no serious consequences for the real economy, but there's no guarantee. Okay, enough of my survey. Next question.
Open bashful, all friends.
I had a comment.
Yeah.
just from listening to your presentation, you predict that 2008 won't have any effect on decreasing the polarization trend that we've seen. What, in my view, I feel like our generation has a lot more in common on different issues than the older generation. As far as Savannah and I were at a conference in Boston a few weeks ago, and we talked about how our generation is more socially liberal, more fiscally conservative, and it just aligns not quite the way that liberal and conservative have aligned in the past. Do you think that 10 years from now or 20 years from now, when our generation is more of the norm, that polarization will decrease, or will the ideological differences not have an effect on that?
That's very interesting. Before I came to Brookings, I founded and for 5 years directed a research center that looked monomaniacally at the civic and political attitudes and behavior of young adults. And there's some bad news for the young Republican. And that is that 20 years ago, young adults ages 18 to 29 were about evenly divided between liberals and conservatives, between Democratic identifiers and Republican identifiers. Since about 1998, there's been an increasing move towards liberal identification and Democratic identification of young adults. And so the balance has shifted. It's also the case that the two areas of convergence that you cite are real. We've seen no such convergence in the area of foreign policy. I mean, Iraq has been a very polarizing event for your generation. And 18 to 29-year-olds who are think of themselves as Republicans and or conservatives tend to feel quite passionately that going into Iraq was the right thing to do, that if we stay the course, we'll produce something that's better for America and better for the world. And to a man and a woman, just about, people who think of themselves as liberals and Democrats disagree with that movement. The other area where, frankly, we haven't seen the convergence, although when you look at the pool as a whole, as opposed perhaps to this somewhat skewed sample that you're is the abortion issue, where the polarization among young adults on that issue is just as deep, as far as I can tell, as it is among the Gen Xers and also the boomers. What that suggests is that the general movement towards convergence on social liberalism may be obstructed to some extent by the continuing centrality of the abortion issue, if abortion remains central in the dialogue over social issues.
I think, though, that I would probably argue that abortion has already become less of an issue. I mean, abortion is certainly less of an issue in 2008 than it was in 2004. I still kind of agree with Sarah. I think that it does seem like on key areas our generation is coming together, and I think that the abortion issue itself is not central to politics anymore.
Okay, but this is to some extent, you're right, but this is an optical illusion to some extent, and I'll tell you how. Social issues and cultural issues tend to be central to political campaigns when you have neither an economic crisis nor a war. This time, we really hit the political jackpot because we have an intensely controversial war and we have an economic crisis. And in these circumstances, you're absolutely right. Cultural issues will have no traction whatsoever. And it'll be interesting to see whether Senator King tries to play any cultural issues tonight. Because raising questions about the Bill Ayers and Jeremiah Wright, etc., that's not talking about foreign policy, it's not talking about the crisis, it's talking about profound cultural issues, divisions that go all the way back to my generation, you know, the late 1960s. So I wouldn't leap to the conclusion that abortion has permanently disappeared from the center of American politics. As long as we're wrestling with economic crises and with controversial wars, it will be a third tier issue. But you know, these issues, you know, they can rise again.
Have a question up here, that may be the last one.
I just wanted to kind of talk about, more like globalization and just going back to what you said earlier about how Americans will see themselves and they're getting better than their parents and things like that. I just wanted to know your opinion about how American identity is going to change after this economic crisis, because from what I've seen, I really think the economic crisis and the war is kind of humbling to an American, and it'll kind of make Americans see themselves differently in the world. So I just kind of wanted your opinion on that. And like just your things that you've seen, the trends you've observed.
I feel like over the entire world, because I'm Sarah, and I feel like
Let me rerun it. Here are the three options. Okay, what are your expectations for 20 or 30 years from now? Will you be living A, better than your parents? B, about as well as your parents? C, worse? How many say A? How many say B? So far it's 9 to 8. How many say C? No. All right. So, not so very different. You know, I mean, given what we've just been through, you know, the fact that, you know, there were no hands for C in the front of the room, and as far as I can tell, only one hand for C in the audience, is it tells me something. I have to say I'm encouraged, because those of us who are somewhat closer to retirement and are looking at what's left of our retirement accounts are not so confident. But I have some things to say about your question, but I've been rattling on. So do you want to respond to that or not respond?
Well, not so much respond, but just to talk, consciousness.
Yeah.
I think it's completely rational for young people to be more optimistic than for older people, because people are either retired or in retirement. And this crisis is all about that. It's about their 401ks. And whereas you don't need to worry quite so much about you know, what you've got to stop talking about. Because over the very long haul, it all bounce back. But on the other hand, if this crisis, as Bill was saying earlier, if the crisis were to extend beyond just a few weeks and go into sort of months and possibly years, then I think probably that would dampen some of the optimism, because it would start affecting your work, your employment prospects, career prospects, and all the rest of it. As for the globalization question, it's very interesting. I think two things. You were absolutely right that for many Americans, this is a humbler and the idea that America has the answer because it's a model, the free market, you know, unfettered, will ultimately, you know, pull it out. very much in doubt in many people's minds at the end. And so, yes, this is a humbling, not even humiliating period. But the flip side of that, of course, is that the world is looking at the American model much more skeptically than before. And so the question is, I mean, this could have profound effects for sort of the prestige and reputation of the United States in the world.
Well, let me answer your question on a somewhat more skeptical note. I don't think we Americans do humility very well, at least not for very long. You know, we regard ourselves as an exceptional nation. And from the very beginning, you know, we've had this conception that somehow, and Ronald Reagan articulated, we were to be a city on the hill, a light unto the Gentiles, to put it mildly. And I am old enough to remember the deep national funk into which we sank after Vietnam, which was A, an out-and-out military defeat for the United States, and B, one that had a shattering effect on the global, you know, the global regard for the United States. We were seen as having perpetrated a wrongful deed and not even having had the fortitude to carry it through to the successful conclusion. So it might be the old joke of two people sitting at home. You know, one says, you know, the food here is really terrible, and the other says, I agree with you, and the portions are too small. Well, and so I think it's very easy to look at where we are, sort of back down on our luck, at home and abroad, and say, well, surely this is going to make us more humble. I would just observe that 5 years after the last American forces were withdrawn from Vietnam in the most humiliating fashion imaginable, the American people decided they'd had enough of humility and the hair-shirt routine, and they elected Ronald Reagan, who proceeded to articulate very, very forcefully, once again, the idea of American exceptionalism, the idea of optimism, progress, America as a model for the world, etc. And that reflected some very deep cultural DNA. Having said that, I'll now question my own argument in the following way. I've given this audience, I think this is probably the best note on which to end. This is the most strongly generational election I have ever seen. If you're under 40, the odds are overwhelming that you're going to be voting for Senator Obama. If you're over 65, the odds are much better than 50-50 you're going to be supporting Senator McCain. And the baby boom generation, the people in between, are more closely divided. I sometimes think that this election is the opening gun in a struggle between new America and old America. And new America is multicultural, it's internationalist in outlook, it tends to believe more in diplomacy and less in force, and it is proud of America, but is not what I would call strongly nationalistic. It is patriotic, but patriotism for new America doesn't mean my country right or wrong, and it doesn't mean that my country is never wrong. Old America is, well, to be blunt about it, Sarah Palin's America. Until 6 weeks ago, before the economic crisis hit, it wasn't clear which was going to be stronger this year, new America or old America. I think it's reasonably clear which is going to be stronger in 2008. It's also pretty clear that in the long run, what I'm calling new America is going to become more dominant in the electorate, in the culture, and in the government. And what I'm calling old America, the America of rural areas and the small towns, is likely to recede. But how long that's going to take,
what's going to happen along the way, I can't tell you. But I can tell you this, when the people in this room are 25 years older and have moved into the front ranks of leadership in business and culture and in government, our country is going to look very, very different.
The Brookings Institution has played an extraordinarily influential role in public life and governance and the formation of public policy, and we're immensely grateful for Pedro and Bill for being here and presenting your research. And I have to say, as someone who has been watching the activities of both of the college political organizations this fall, I'm very excited by the amount of energy and the amount of involvement that you all have got. I think the future is a hell of a lot better than the past in this country. So Savannah, Amanda, thank you very much. Sarah and Susan, thank you very much. Thank all of you for participating.